Order the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Colleagues, today is April 27th, 2011, and we are convened for a public hearing and possible work session on a number of bills. I anticipate mostly going in almost going in order. We will start with House Bill 2212A, then go to House Bill 2213, then back up to House Bill 2199, and then to House Bill 2807, 2809, 3032, and 3105. However, depending on how much testimony we receive on the other bills, 3032 may jump in front, depending on when Representative Berger gets here. So we're hoping to do that potentially at a time certain of 1:30, and that's 3032. That being said, I will go ahead, and seeing that Representative Kampf is here, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2212A. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2212A comes to you from the House with a vote of 3723. The measure prohibits floor order facilitators from receiving or charging consideration for individual orders with certain exceptions. It requires floor order facilitators to pay delivery charges and other amounts to direct providers of floor or plant arrangements or related services within a reasonable time period. It designates violations of this to be an unlawful trade practice. The measure has an emergency clause and would take effect upon passage. No fiscal impact, no revenue impact, no amendments, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Kampf.
Oh, I have no idea what I have. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betty Kampf, and I represent House District 22, which includes the cities of Woodburn, Jervis, and as well as Northeast Salem. And I feel like I've been in a rush because we spent a long time on a bill for Senator Boquist on the floor this morning. He had to come help us out, and so we're in a little bit of a time crunch, but as always, Senator Boquist took care of it just fine.
Well, you got me on the edge of my seat. Could you at least give us a hint of what the bill was?
Well, the bill was a resolution about whether if Oregon should prepare for emergency or not.
I can see why that would be controversial.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's like, well, we need a 2/3 vote. But now that the rest of the world knows what we're doing in the House while the Senate's working hard. Today I want to talk to you about House Bill 2212. It's a floral bill. And when you look at this bill, the beginning parts of the bill are very helpful because it gives definitions. It's like any career field. It has its own terminology, and so it might help you. I have a good friend with me today, Cindy Wardiner Kelly, and another member of the Florist Association, and they have a lot more detail, and they will be using some of the terms that I just don't use in schools, but they understand. Today in Oregon, the floral business is a multi-million industry. It supplies literally thousands of jobs. And a lot of our florists are small local florists. I know most of the members of this committee live in much bigger communities, but if you live in Silverton, you live in well, I think we still might have a florist in Mount Angel, or Cindy might have that. But we used to have several florists in Woodburn, and now we just have one. And yet it's very interesting how they advertise and how the combination of charges that have been put on florists over the years. Most local florists provide their independent small owners of businesses. They're high, Senator.
My ears were burning. I heard it. I'm being tarred and feathered by my own members. I'm glad somebody doesn't like me, though, Betty.
I thought your bill was a good bill. So, but today, the floral businesses rely on their websites. They look at different types of advertising to make sure that people know where they're ordering their flowers from. Many, many out-of-state corporations have floral orders, and that we all, well, some of us are old enough to remember when we used to see the first TV commercials about FTD and that they're for a floral charge, that they would make sure that you had fresh flowers coming from your local florist. Well, those charges have not changed in all those years, and those charges are up to 20%. Senators, I think it's a little bit unjustified and outrageous. Where it used to be people that answered the phone, took the orders, made sure that they knew exactly what kind of flowers the customers wanted, and today all that is done with just a click of your mouse. And yet those same costs are still applied to the local florist. House Bill 2212 would fix that. It would put a cap on where the order originators can charge local florists. It would require that the delivery fee be charged to the consumer, cannot be charged to a local florist. There's a multitude of different charges that get pushed back and forth. But I'm going to let the two local experts, Cindy's more of a small town independent florist, and our friend Keith here has, well, I'll let him talk about it, but one of the biggest florists he is one of the biggest florists in the state, maybe even on the West Coast. So they have two different perspectives, and I welcome your questions and hope you find this interesting. We have done quite a bit of research with Department of Justice on consumer federal protections and that sort of thing, and we have staff here to answer any legal questions about that if you have those. So thank you, and I do miss Senator Boquist, and you can come back to the House anytime you want.
I think I'd be lynched today.
Okay. Thank you, Committee Administrator Brennan, and also the Senate committee members. Thank you for allowing us to talk today.
And Chair Shields.
Yes. Okay.
My
name is Cindy Wardinger Kelly, and I own Valley Pacific Floral in Woodburn, Oregon. And thank you, Representative Comp, for also allowing this bill to get this far. Okay. Not too close. Okay. Flowers.
Excuse me. Real quickly, Cindy, I don't see your last name on the testimony. Could you give that to us again?
It's Cindy Wardinger Kelly, and that's spelled Wardinger hyphen Kelly, Kelly.
Great. Thank you very much. Please continue.
Flowers by Wire was first started in 1910 by a group of florists on the East Coast. This network of florists wanted their fresh, perishable product delivered all around the world. And so they used this network to transfer their orders back and forth. And then in 1914, the Mercury Man was introduced as a way to show efficiency and speed to deliver their perishable products. And that logo is still used today. A lot of you might be familiar with it. Then in 1965, at that time also, it was the FTD system was adopted, and it was a member co-op. And the structure of it went where the flower order was originated, they received 20% commission for the order. And then FTD took 7% commission to handle the transaction of the money. So like they would pay the commissions out at the end of the month, and then the filling florist would get the leftover, which was 73%. And this worked well for nearly 100 years until the birth of the Internet. And in the beginning, it was the telegraph system, and it cost a little bit more than it does today. Now the Internet is virtually free, long distance is free, and so the structure has never changed in over 100 years, and so that's why we're here today. What's happened is small and large unscrupulous companies have popped up all over the world, and majority of them are in the United States. And what they have done is they've found a loophole in the system to where they're not filling orders anymore. They're just gathering orders. And what they do is they come into a small town like Woodburn, Oregon, where we're the only flower shop there. But if you do a Google search for flowers delivered in Woodburn, Oregon, you'll notice that there's 39 pages of florists claiming to deliver locally in our city. And what they've done is they've gone so far as to take the name of my business, Valley Pacific Floral, and they've put them in their, on the search engine in their ads. They've taken my local phone number with the, so that the consumer can see the 981 prefix. And they've also gone so far as to take in the name of my the first name of the owners in these small cities. Like they might design a website that says Flowers by Cindy. And then when the consumer goes in, they think, oh, there's Cindy, or my friends from Woodburn will see there's Cindy, and they click on the URL. Little do they know that this order actually then, that URL takes them out of state. And if it ends up in with an order gatherer in, let's say, California, not only are they paying a $20, up to $20 handling fee, they're also paying 8.25% sales tax for California. And then what happens is the order, through via the order facilitator, comes back to me in Woodburn, and so the consumer has no idea that a third party vendor has been used, and that they have actually, the money comes back to us in trifle amounts, and they don't even realize that they haven't selected us in the first place. And so what we're hoping that this bill will do is change the commission structure so that the order originator will still get, they'll get 5% of the commission rather than 20%. And then the extra 15% will go to the filling florist, which the cost to fill flowers to make the bouquets and deliver them has gone up greatly since 1910. And the cost of communication has gone down. So we feel that this has been needed to be done for a long time. In fact, they even tried it years ago, about 10 years ago. They did try to change the commission. But what happened was everybody just jumped ship and then used another company so that they could get the bigger commission on the front end. So that's why we feel that this law is necessary to make it fair for everybody across the board. Let's see, I'm going to let Keith talk for a minute in case there's anything I forgot. And he has some perspective on how it's going to affect his business. So go ahead, Keith.
Greetings. My name is Keith Hill. I am a florist in Beaverton, Oregon. I come to the flower industry after doing dentistry for 20 years, and I have to tell you, I look at it with a little bit different eyes than most florists. I'm not a designer. I'm not a. I buy the flowers and hope that the designers will put them together right, and we've been fairly successful. Our shop is a very large shop for flower shops. We have 20 employees. We do about $2.5 million in sales. We're ranked in FTD, which is the one of the wire services that many, and you can see here, they give away free shirts.
It isn't free.
So we do a lot of orders. We're a big business. We're, and as flower shops go, we're a very, very small business as business goes. But we send approximately 4,000 orders a year out of town, which is enough to make us in the top 100 in FTD's ranking. We, with this law, we would stand to lose about $35,000 because we collect the 20% of the 4,000 orders. The reality is this law is, while it is going to cost me some money, it's the right thing to do. This is something that has drastically impacted the flower industry in not just Oregon, but nationwide. The numbers of flower shops are dropping astronomically in the last 3 or 4 years, mainly because of the cost structure set up with the sending and receiving. As Cindy alluded, cost of communications, as we all know, are dramatically less than they were. And what that has done is it's created this profit center for the people we consider order gatherers, who are simply trying to grab the order and then send it to somebody else to have it filled. That 20% is, instead of being a profit center for a out-of-state company, we feel should be available to the local florist, especially in Oregon, that is providing the service, hiring the employees, paying the taxes, buying the vans, and doing all of those things that are required to run a flower shop. And the reason that we have that, one of the questions was, well, how come you just don't not take those orders? You know, just simply refuse them. Well, the problem is that the order gathering business and wire service business set up in 1910 those are national businesses. And for those national groups to get together and say, you know, we should lower the percentage because it's not good for local florists, that would be considered collusion.
Antitrust, yeah.
It would be restraint of trade. But if one of them did it, and in 1989, FTD lowered the commission rate on orders to 90-10, and all of the order gatherers simply sent their orders with Teleflora. They lost 400,000 orders in 1 month. When that happened, that set the precedent, and nobody will ever touch that one again because they don't want to lose. The wire services make their money on the 7% of the money going through their system. And for them to lose 400,000 orders is way, they lost 7% of 400,000 orders. So they're not going to, they won't touch it. It can only be accomplished on a state-by-state basis. We happen to be Oregon, which is known for its innovative legislation. And this is something that I think that if we can accomplish here, that it will go to other states. I've already been approached by people in South Carolina, California, West Virginia. They're all interested in this law because if it gets passed here, then they're going to introduce it there because it's good for the local business. That it's really, it's a nonpartisan issue that's simply good for local businesses. And if we can get it passed, I think it would be a benefit to the local florists, especially the smaller ones who rely on those incoming orders. Any questions?
No, thank you very much for your testimony. I do have a question. Actually, go ahead, Senator Monroe, and then I'll come back.
How do you get around the Interstate Commerce Clause? I mean, you do business outside of the state of Oregon, I'm sure. So how do you get around the Interstate Commerce Clause?
Our delivery area is the Portland Metro Vancouver, but we don't deliver to Vancouver. So, are you talking about wire orders?
Well, yeah, you know what the Interstate Commerce Clause is, right?
Yes.
Any commerce that crosses state line only can be regulated by the federal government, not by a state.
I believe there was a ruling. The last one that was heard was in the 50s regarding wire service transmission of orders, and they have an exemption from that clause because of the ability. Because of the ability to send and receive orders, there was no federal monies to be made in the situation, and so they basically allowed that if a florist in Oregon took an order for New York, he would take the order, he would send the money to FTD or Teleflora, one of the wire services, they would then send it to that florist in that state, and they would pay the sales tax at that end. We don't have sales tax, so it's not a...
Add something to that. This law, if it goes into effect, is only going to affect mainly the consumers in Oregon. So if, like, somebody in Florida wants to send flowers to Oregon, and they get online and they look up a flower shop, and they don't find a flower shop, they find an order gatherer that's not in Oregon, in that particular case, this law will not affect them. They still are going to be at whatever rate is precedent by FTD, because we can't regulate money coming in, but we can regulate, the state of Oregon can regulate the funds that are going to be going out if they're taking them from Oregon consumers.
Okay.
And we do have somebody from LC.
I see Marissa.
Okay.
And I just,
we got a lawyer on this committee too that can probably help us out.
A lot of lawyer wannabes.
No, and here.
We're not judiciary, Mr. Chair.
Can I just make sure I understand the fee structure? You said the wire services get 7%, and
right.
Then what you called the order gatherers get 20%?
Right. But the way it's worded in this law, they call everybody floral facilitators.
Okay.
But we've tried to explain that there's an originating floral facilitator, a transmitting floral facilitator, and a filling. So there's three parts to any order being sent. The person who takes the order, the person who transmits it, and then the person who fills it. Now, in the simplest case, if a person calls me on the phone, I take the order, I transmit the order to my design department, and they send it to the delivery department, and we deliver it. It's all done. It's all one company. If we use a company like FTD that's going out of state, then we will take the order, send it to FTD, who then will send it to another flower shop. If it's the case, it gets confusing because FTD.com actually has their own order gathering arm who can take an order and then send it through FTD to us. So there'll be the originator, the transmitter, and we will build the filler. It gets complicated as it goes along. That's why we tried to write it in such a way.
If you look at this little graph that I made, it kind of shows right here. If it starts the purchasing floral consumer, then the money goes, and what it entails is the cost of the floral product, the delivery charge, and the handling charge, and then. If you look at the chart, it kind of goes across, and you can see the breakdown. 5% stays here with the order originator. 7% goes to the floral facilitator, which is like FTD or Teleflora, and that's the fee that they charge for handling the financial part of it, the money transaction, you know, doling out the structure back to the originator or the filling florist. And then 88% will go to the direct provider, which is the flower shop that fills the order. And then the consumer, the ultimate floral consumer, gets 100% of the money of the product, minus the delivery charge and minus the handling fee.
And basically what you're arguing is that there's a market failure in that having kind of the institutional middleman or middle person involved means that if somebody wants to lower their prices, they're hit unfairly, and it distorts the market.
Yeah, basically, because what they're doing now is because they have such a huge share of it because of the advertising dollars on the internet, and that's how the majority of flower sales are made now, that they just target, they offer coupons, they offer free delivery, but they don't care because they're not the one handling the finished product. So the consumer is the one that's going to get it in the long run, because obviously if you keep delivering the product for free, you're going to go out of business. So what some shops do is they don't get the delivery fee because the other guy keeps it. They minus another $10 out of the consumer's bouquet. And so then instead of getting a $50 bouquet, he's getting a $40 one. And that's what's happening across the United States, because you just can't stay in business and give everything away for free. They're also showing a picture on the internet of a dozen roses for $29.95. Well, you know, that's great. It sounds good, but in the real world, it's going to cost more than that.
Yeah.
So.
And we've heard similar stories from a whole variety of industries. Are the banks running the floral industry?
That was my question.
Well, some of the coupons come out in the bank statements, I've noticed.
Senator Bocas.
I'm just clarifying. I mean, we're setting structure, like we set the structure in the seed councils and places like that. We're not setting fees specifically, right? The fee portion has been removed.
There's no fees involved. No.
Yeah, it's okay. The structure. Yeah, right. That would be correct.
I see it as putting 15% more dollars into a local florist's budget that they will be able then to have the money to hire other people to help them, money to pay their, you know, it's a win-win for the local florist.
And for the state of Oregon, because we're estimating, just by my small flower shop in Woodburn, I kind of ran the numbers and came up with $1.5 million statewide if all 235 flower shops were my size. But I'm small, so I went conservative figuring it. And if each shop has those orders back in Oregon, that could be up to two more employees per flower shop. So we're hoping to look at another 500 jobs.
Right. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. First of all, I remember, Cindy, welcome back, that you were here last session, and I wanted to ask about the bill that you worked with Representative Comp on last session. And
okay.
Did that go through?
It
and
did
still
go
was it helping?
Through, and we're... It's helping a little. I've noticed it's just such a huge industry that they're willing to take that $25,000 hit from the Department of Justice for advertising in the phone books. And just to give a quick brief description, this is going to go hand in hand with that first law. But what it was if they advertise in the phone book, they or any printed material or on the internet by law, they now are required to put the physical location of where they're at. But what they're doing is they're putting it on the internet. They're putting it in very small print on the About Us page, and still maybe 60% of them don't have it anywhere on their website. Instead, they just try to make the consumer think that they're actually in your city. And so the Department of Justice, I've been working with them for the last year and a half, and we've sent in probably in my shop alone, we've sent in over 50 violations of the phone book and on the internet. But they are gathering information, and they're waiting to get enough because they don't want to take it to court until they can, you know, be sure that they will win it. And the internet one, we're going to have to do an amendment because they told me that it wasn't, the way it was written, it's not strict enough for them to enforce the full physical address. It just says the disclosure of their location. And so they're still, they said they could take it to court, but it's just a little bit too vague for them to feel like they could win it. So we're going to work on that next session.
Thank you. And then I also had another question. I wondered, because I'm looking at your chart where you assume the purchasing for our customers in Oregon. So how would this apply if, for example, I'm in Oregon and I want to buy flowers for someone out of state, or if somebody out of state wants to buy flowers for me here?
If you get on the internet, okay, and you want to send flowers to California, and you order from an order gatherer, then by law, this will take effect, and the 5% will stay with whichever order gathering company you use. Okay? If you choose a local flower shop, in California, then you're subject to the sales tax and whatever handling fee.
And what if somebody in another state wants to purchase flowers for somebody here in Oregon? How does this take effect then? Because it isn't an Oregon consumer.
Right. If they use an order gathering company that is not in Oregon, then it won't do anything. But we're hoping that the wire services, there's really only four main ones. There's FTD, Teleflora, 1-800-Flowers, Flower Shop Network, and there's a couple other smaller ones. We're hoping that they will take effect and make it straight across the board for everybody. But by law, it's only going to affect the flowers delivered here in our state and any orders that are originated here in Oregon. So it's not going to hit everybody, but it's going to be pretty close.
Any flowers, any order, any person transmitting orders into Oregon will be required to send the 88%.
Right.
Just a comment. Senator Bonamici, Senator Shields, the comment that I would make is, it's where Cindy started. It takes maybe one state to start a change. And the reality is these four main companies have a monopoly. They literally have a monopoly over the rest of the nation.
A virtual monopoly.
Yes, it is virtual. In literal terms. And unless somebody stands up and fights and says, no, we're not going to be giving you 20% of our order anymore, just because there's only four big guns here, and that we think that, you know, we can't win this fight. And so to the fact that there are many, many states watching us, they were surprised when we got our first legislation passed about authentic advertisements, because, again, people were just thinking, oh, nobody will enforce it. And we know our Attorney General is pretty firm on some of these types of situations, and the AG's office has been very helpful. They want to make sure that things can work the way we want them to, and I want to congratulate Cindy and her colleagues to say, hey, enough is enough, and particularly the fact that I know that there's many times when I would like to order flowers, but I don't feel like I can afford them, and then to find out that $20 goes to some big corporation just is pretty outrageous. And yet we want our florists in our town. They are the ones that provide our flowers for our weddings, our funerals, our celebrations, our birthdays, Mother's Day. But without them, it would be a real loss to our communities. And so it's what Cindy has been doing is a yeoman's job here, and we just, yeah, if your consideration would be appreciated.
All right. Any further questions?
Senator Monroe.
Just for my information, what percentage of the flowers that are delivered in from Oregon florists in Oregon are actually grown in Oregon?
Anymore, maybe some of the plants, but I don't know of any. There's a rose grower in, where's Peter Court, yeah. Beaverton?
Yeah, we have about
greenhouses, things like
yeah,
that.
I buy about, in the summertime, about 20% of my cut flowers come from Oregon, because I would much rather buy Oregon. They don't have to ship, they don't have to pay the shipping. So there are still viable flower growers in Dayton, Hillsboro, around that we buy from. We're limited by the season, though.
And there's a lot of small retail shops like myself. We have a couple acres, and we grow a lot of our own stuff through the summer, too. So.
Okay. Well, we're going to need to move on, but we do appreciate you bringing this forward. We're probably going to vote on this, but we're just not going to vote on it right now today, but I do appreciate you bringing this forward. I think it's the essence of what small business protection, part of our committee, should be all about, and I thank you for bringing it. And I also want to thank you, Keith, for coming forward to stand in support of a bill that's going to cost you money. I think that's very noble, and that's what the public interest is all about. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
I will close. Okay. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2212. And she can wait. Yeah. Okay. Representative Berger is gracious enough to let you continue. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2213.
Okay. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2213 delegates responsibility for selecting a chairperson and vice chairperson for the Commission for Women to the members of the Commission. The measure has an emergency clause, takes effect upon passage. No fiscal or revenue impact. The vote in the House is 58-0.
Chair Shields and committee, I'll be very brief. This is exactly what the summary is. We want to have permission to allow us to elect an officer for the Oregon Women's Commission. This is comparable to the same bylaws that we have for Hispanic Affairs, of Commission on Black Affairs and Asian Affairs. And our current bylaws have not allowed us to elect our own chairperson by vote, and that's what we're requesting to do with this bill.
Okay. All right. Questions for Representative Kump? My constituent, Sunny Pettit.
Hello.
Yes. Sunny's the pro.
Thank you, Chair Shields and Senate Committee members.
This is also, as Representative Comp said, this is just something to put us in line with the rest of the Advocacy Commission's laws, and it's a way that we can show that our membership is selecting somebody who we feel is a very strong leader, and we urge you to consider it favorably.
Yes. Good questions?
Sure.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I'm shocked, really. I didn't realize this was the case. I serve on the Commission on Black Affairs. We choose our own chair and vice chair every year. Do you know the history of how it got this way?
I believe that it was because the Commission for Women was founded in 1964, and it just hasn't been updated as the Advocacy Commission office has expanded.
It became statutory in 1983.
And Senator Shields and Senator Monroe, I have to make a comment. Women just take a little longer to get what we deserve, so. You knew that was coming.
Since you put it that way, I have to pass the bill. Any further questions? Colleagues, I think I would like to just go ahead and move this along. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2213 and open a work session on House Bill 2213. Let's see. Senator George?
Yeah. Would you like me to make a motion?
Please.
I move 2213 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici has moved House Bill 2213 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Debbie, could you please call the roll?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
Yes.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Excused.
Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. Motion passes. Senator Boquist, would
I'd be happy to carry it. That way I don't have to carry the other one.
All right.
I've been charged feathered enough today.
I will close the work session on House Bill 2213 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3032. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3032 allows county courts and county boards of commissions to examine the financial affairs of the county at regular business meetings twice during each year at any time rather than in January and July, as is currently required by statute. The measure passed the House floor 60-0, has no fiscal or revenue impact, no amendments, Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger,
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is for the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20, and I have brought with me, with your indulgence, former State Representative and current Marion County Commissioner Janet Carlson. She basically brought me this bill. It's very simple. Our statutes appropriately say that the Board of Commissioners or the county court in those counties that have a county court will carefully examine all the books and papers relating to those other elected county offices, which is appropriate, but unfortunately it specifies exactly which month they do it in, and in a modern era of electronics it's sort of archaic, and so this proposes to change it to two times a year and let those elected officials decide which months they want to do it in. And with that introduction, I think the expert is beside me.
Well, thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee, Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. Yes, before you, you see a real memo that was sent to us last fall, October 11th to be exact, and we rotate the chairmanship of the commission, so I was serving as chair, as you can see. I signed off on it. It was from our legal counsel, bringing it to our attention that we had been lax in doing our semi-annual review of books and papers of the clerk, the sheriff, and the county treasurer. Now, this is kind of interesting because we do very extensive budget hearings in Marion County. We probably spend a good 5-6 full days. Some counties do it rather rapidly, but we take a lot of time. In that time, we have computerized reports of revenues, reports of expenditures, past reports, projections. We have a quarterly report that we get from our financial staff. We convene our budget committee generally February, March to kind of give them a preview of what the budget's going to look like. Very difficult to convene a citizen budget committee in July with vacation schedules, so we generally try to do that around September to prepare them for the end of the year. Our treasurer provides a monthly report. It gets routed. Our sheriff provides a monthly report. We have management updates. Meetings weekly, and if there's anything untoward, we get information there. However, we were not doing it in January and in You know, those are the 2 months that are required, right. January and July. So when it came to my attention, we actually scheduled a meeting in December, which was contrary to the statute, and then we were going to try to schedule a meeting actually in January to get on the right foot, but by the time we got everyone together, it was February. So we have not been in compliance for a very long time. So in the discussion with legal counsel, I said, well, maybe we could actually just change this law. So I contacted Association of Oregon Counties. Staff there, Mike Eliason, contacted Representative Berger. She was gracious enough to put forward this bill. As she said, it's a very simple bill, and we would appreciate your consideration.
Okay. Any questions?
I had a simple one earlier today, so.
Life is
I'm on with you.
Life is never simple. We understand
that. That's right.
All right. Well, if there are no questions, I think I would just want to move this along. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3032. I presume there's no one else who wants to testify on this. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 3032. Senator Bonamici.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3032 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici moves House Bill 3032 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Excused.
And Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. Motion passes. Senator Monroe, would you like to carry that?
Oh, sure.
Senator Monroe will be the carrier on House Bill 3032. And I will close the work session on House Bill 3032. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2199. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2199 eliminates the Task Force on Impact of the Oregon Opportunity Program at Oregon Health and Science University. The measure came through the House with a vote of 60-0, has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact and no amendments, Mr. Chair.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields and members of the committee. I'm Ellen Lowe, and I appear today as chair of the Oregon Opportunity Task Force, and I really want to thank you so very much for expediting this hearing. With the unanimous approval of the other 12 task force members, which, by the way, includes four legislators, Senators Nelson, Telfer, and Representatives Reed and Vance, I respectfully request that you join the House in viewing House Bill 2199 with favor and pass it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I'm sure, as you hear from Dr. Daniel Dorsett, that you will share the conclusion that we came to as a task force and also that of the Secretary of State, that we completed our assignment from the 2001 Legislative Assembly. And we also lived up to all the promises we made in the brochure we distributed during the ballot measure campaign. Now, our primary role as a task force was to review the impact of the Oregon Opportunity on OHSU's core missions of teaching, patient care, research, and community service. Now, I was one of three public members, and I filled the position for an advocate for persons who are medically underserved. And I do acknowledge nudging the task force to give special attention to monitoring the maintenance of high-quality clinical care for vulnerable populations. And as we did so, we discovered that rather than being compromised by the Oregon Opportunity, we found the core missions of OHSU were actually enhanced by the additional connections that were built among research, clinical care, and teaching. OHSU does function as a community of care for the wider community. Now, during this current time, when Oregon has a fiscal and moral imperative to to support quality health care at less cost, part of that triple aim. I wish to highlight the contribution that the Center of Medical Excellence has made in providing world-renowned information on value-based benefits and the participation of the OHSU faculty on the expert panels for the Health Services Commission, which I observed as a member for 16 years. That effort continues today as the essential benefit packages are determined. OHSU really does serve all of us. Now, our first chair, Senator Hartung, began the practice of providing time at the end of our meetings for public comment, and this was a practice that I continued. All of our meetings were posted ahead of time. We did observe the open meeting law, and we were never without observers on or public testimony. The public testimony generally centered on the last of our legislative assignments, and that was to review whether animal research is being done in an ethical and humane manner. And please note our task was to review how, not if. And we heard numerous allegations of mistreatment, so I appointed a subcommittee, including myself, with then-Representative Butler as the chair. And there were visits to the center and countless hours spent reviewing all of the state and federal reviews, as well as hearing from the principals doing the research. The entire task force joined in much of this review and concurred with our subcommittee's findings that the research was being done in a humane manner and needed no additional oversight beyond the existing federal, state, institutional, and professional reviews. I have stacks of materials that we looked at. I need to acknowledge the thoroughness and the professionalism of OHSU's response. This was done within an often hostile environment created by some of those bringing the unfounded charges. While the investigation of these charges took countless hours of task force and faculty time, it did not keep us from seeing the relationship, the interdependency of the medical, research, and teaching functions at the university. We can say that healing, teaching, and discovery can and do come together at OHSU. Now, the Oregon Opportunity Task Force is ready to view from afar, at least the three of us who are public members, the pursuit of medical excellence, of which it was a very small part for 10 years. And now Dr. Dorsa will provide you a glimpse of some of the programs and progress that is currently part of OHSU. Dr. Dorsa.
Thank you. Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Dan Dorsa. I'm Vice President for Research at Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm pleased to be here today to underwrite the comments that you just heard. If I just distill down the intent of the Oregon Opportunity Task Force, it really was to assure the state that the investments that were being made in research through the Oregon Opportunity were not going to undermine the other important missions of OHSU in clinical care, education, and outreach. And I'm here today to tell you that it is absolutely clear that that did not happen, that in fact the investment actually augmented all those other missions. There are a number of indicators of that. You can use rankings and U.S. News and World Report of our clinical, of our educational programs in family medicine and primary care, and so forth, which are in the top five in the country by their rating and by other ratings that are available. Our School of Nursing is one of the best in the nation, according again to U.S. News and World Report, with strengths in gerontology and family nurse practitioner areas, and is seventh for its master's degree program in nursing. Relating to that, of course, you're probably aware that there is a statewide collaborative that is the acronym for which is OCNI, which is really turning out and training many more nurses than we did previously in 2002. Our School of Dentistry continues to really do well in the area of education. 97% of the students there pass in their first exam. Enrollments are up from 2002, a total of 2,721 students, and almost 900 degrees awarded per year. I would point out to you that we're now embarking on a collaborative effort in the educational area in the Life Sciences Building on the waterfront with the collaboration with the Oregon University System. This, in some sense, I think, is an outgrowth of the Oregon Opportunity Investment, and we're going to now be working both educationally and in terms of collaborative research in that building. Patient care clearly expanded over those years in any measure you might select in terms of numbers of beds, surgical cases, ambulatory visits, which were 686,000 ambulatory visits in 2010. And inpatient contact days. We are serving more of the underserved patients in the state than ever before, and that has continued to be a core part of our mission over all of those years. We did use the Oregon Opportunity money in part to expand our clinical faculty and our clinical faculty leadership in the departments that are important, such as in our neurosciences area, cancer, oncology, cardiovascular, orthopedics, and so forth. So we recruited some really high-end individuals with that money who are now superb leaders in our institution and are leading not only the clinical but the educational activities in those departments. OHSU Hospital is the number one ranked among in the Portland metro area, according to U.S. News World and World Report, with the new ranking they just came out with, which is best hospitals in metro areas. In terms of the impact on research, I would direct your attention to, if you have not already seen it, the audit report that came from the Secretary of State's office, and we ask that a copy be distributed to you if you had not seen that, which basically said that we performed on all of the aspects of that were embodied in the agreement with the state about the expectations for the Oregon Opportunity in terms of numbers of investigators recruited, additional staff, the creation of new research facilities, a new building of 100 that provided an additional 175,000 square feet of space was created. The School of Medicine at OHSU moved into the top 20, as was also anticipated in terms of NIH funding, the National Institutes of Health. That was achieved as well. I guess also point to the fact that there has been a significant increase in the commercialization efforts of our institution. Since 2002, we have spun out 28 different startup companies based on OHSU technology. The vast majority of those remain in the state of Oregon and are employing somewhere between 200 and 300 people. In terms of community outreach, one of the other things we created that has been extremely successful and I think valued throughout the state is ORPRN, which is the practice Rural Practice Network, which is really an infrastructural element to be able to conduct research at sites throughout the state in rural communities, in primary practice settings and in family practice settings that are addressing research questions that are of importance to the clinicians in those areas. Has been very successful and brought in a lot of external support into the state. And on average, so just last year, we brought in into the state from outside, including federal money, about $400 million of funding for our research programs. And we hope that that will continue to grow over the next few years. The point being that the investment is sort of a gift that continues to give these via those faculty that we recruited. So finally, I guess what I would summarize to say is that it was a fantastic investment. It frankly is what brought me here to the state from the University of Washington. I thought it was remarkable that the state chose to make such an investment in research, and it was I've been honored over these years to help enact and carry it out. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Monroe?
Well, just a comment. I've had the privilege to do the OHSU budget the last two biennia as chair of the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and I've come to really appreciate what a jewel OHSU is, not only in terms of the medical profession, but the economy of Oregon, the economy of our state, the largest employer in the Portland area, one of the finest teaching hospitals in the world, not just in the United States. I don't think the people that live in this state and in the Portland area have a full appreciation for OHSU and its value in many ways. And so I'd like to thank you, Doctor, for coming and sharing your testimony with us.
Thank you.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to echo the comments Senator Monroe made and also thank OHSU and LMO for all your work on this to date. And I know that, Ellen, you've done so much for the community that even if we statutorily remove this task, you will still remain very busy.
And I moved out to Portland in 96, and it seems like every physician that I ever met that worked at OHSU often talked about, oh yeah, I studied medicine or I did my residency at Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis and Washington University Medical School, very well-renowned medical school in the country, but they always ended up out here at OHSU. I found that to be very interesting that that you're attracting such talent away from such prestigious universities and hospitals and other places. So I commend you for your work, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2199. No one else wanted to testify on this, I presume. Okay, and we're going to move this on a different day. So I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2809. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
2809.
House Bill 2809 deletes the requirement for certain special districts to sign and countersign contracts, deeds, warrants, releases, receipts, and other documents. The measure has no fiscal or revenue impact. Moved out of the House on a 58-0 vote. And there are no amendments, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So I understand how I threw you off. I thought we were going to go to 28-7.
Yeah, it's just the numerical order thing. It's no problem.
So we will
forget you're in charge, Mr. Chair.
No, I made a mistake. So we will do 2809 now, then go to 2807, and then to 3105, and then we should be done.
Okay.
So
thank you.
Who do we have?
Well, we can just bring them up.
Yeah.
Come up while we're
seeing if they come up.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. For what it's worth, Patrick, he threw me for a loop, too, because I wasn't ready for this bill, so I had annexation in my head, which is the next bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today regarding House Bill 2809. For the record, my name is Hasina Squires. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. ORS 198 currently provides for the ability of creation of approximately 30 different types of special districts. This bill is very, very simple. There are four types of special districts, parks and recreation districts, radio data districts, sanitary authorities, and sanitary districts that currently have statutory language that require that all contracts, deeds, warrants, releases, receipts, some of these things, I'm not sure what they are, and documents of every kind shall be signed in the name of the district by its board president and countersigned by its secretary. Our special districts are governed by elected board of directors directors, either three or seven, depending on the type of special district. These four types of special districts, for some reason, have this provision in statute, and we would like to repeal those sections of statute. We feel that it's unnecessary to require a board president and secretary counter-signature that interrupts the workflow when we have district managers that are should be empowered to take care of administrative business of the district. With me today is Bob Kiefer, the general manager of Willamette Lane Parks and Recreation District, that brought this issue to our attention on behalf of Parks and Rec districts. Then we searched the rest of the statute with legislative council and found these three other statutes existing in three different special districts. So,
all right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Shields, members of the committee, as Sina mentioned, my name is Bob Kiefer. I'm the superintendent of the Willamette Lane Park and Recreation District in Springfield, and also I have another role with special districts as the vice chair of the board of directors. And I've served on the legislative committee for many years and finally got to a bill that really hit me like it was like, why are we doing this? And I've served as administrator in a park and recreation district for over 17 years. And as we went through our business, always the general manager, superintendent, the head, was responsible, delegated authority to sign contracts, sign everything from timesheets to, you know, to multi-million dollar contracts. And then you find this provision where it says that of every document of every kind. So are we in violation of those types of rules? And that sort of made us come forward and say, we need to fix this. And not only is it just something that is onerous, it is also very ineffective government. And I think that this is the time when we should be looking at how can we be as effective as we and as efficient as we can in governmental service. So I think it's just a great bill. It's a housekeeping bill, and I encourage your support of the bill.
All right. Any questions? Okay. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2809 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2807.
Thank you.
Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2807 authorizes annexation of territory of a dissolved district by a district formed under the same principal act. It allows for allocation of indebtedness between a district and territory annexed by the district, subjects the territory annexed to a permanent rate limit and local option taxes of the annexing district. The measure would take effect on the 91st day following adjournment of the legislative session. The measure moved out of the House on a 57-0 vote, has no fiscal revenue impact, and no amendments.
See.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Members of the committee, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, in support of House Bill 2807, another what we believe to be government efficiency bill. There are approximately 950 special districts that belong to our association. The most prolific type of special district is a rural fire protection district, of which there are approximately 300 of the 950. And we find these rural fire protection districts exploring efficiencies as a result of ballot measure 50 and reduced property tax revenue. So it's common for districts to, particularly fire districts, to look at mergers, consolidations, annexations. And in the course of looking at those statutes, we found a section of statute ORS 198-900, which currently provides for in a petition for a merger or consolidation. So there's merger, consolidation, and annexation, that these districts may execute what are called debt distribution management plans. So essentially, if I'm a fire district and I'm going to merge or consolidate with another district, I can execute a debt distribution management plan. So what happens to general obligation bonded indebtedness that exists prior to the merger or the consolidation? That is what a debt distribution management plan is and what would be spelled out in it. Unfortunately, annexation does not also exist in the set. It should be merger, consolidation, or annexation. We have districts that it's more common than not to annex another rural fire protection district. So that's one of the provisions of House Bill 2807, and the main provision is just to add the word annexation to ORS 198-900. We have a couple of other technical changes. We worked with the Department of Revenue in crafting the language of this piece of legislation. I'll go from the reverse up in the bill. Section 2 of the bill clarifies that a district may annex territory of a dissolved district. It's current practice for a district to annex the territory formerly occupied by another district, and that's what the language in Section 2 says, is that you may do that when something goes away, you may annex that territory. Section 3 of the bill does two things. It clarifies the existing annexation statute, ORS 198-860, that outstanding indebtedness may be allocated by a debt distribution management plan. That's the item I already discussed. And also that annexed territory is subject to the annexing district's permanent tax rate and any outstanding local option levies. That's current practice, but it's not clearly stipulated in statute. And then Section 4 of the bill adds annexations to the statute that currently allows mergers and consolidations to execute debt distribution plans. So those are the three portions of the bill. With me today is Alec Jensen, Executive Officer of Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, who brought this issue to our attention. There have been exploring potential annexation of a neighboring fire district, and it just came up as an issue that, hey, if we did annex, we're not really clear in the statute that we can actually enter into a debt distribution management plan.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, I am Alec Jensen. I'm the executive officer of Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. We serve 440,000 people in the west and south metro area. We're a relatively new local government formed in 1989 through a series of mergers, consolidations, annexations, and in the normal course of our year, we often find ourselves, responding to requests from neighboring jurisdictions looking to achieve some efficiencies. Most recently, we've been in discussions with a rural fire protection district to the west, Washington County Fire District Number 2, again exploring the operational and economic efficiencies of a possible annexation of that district. A question came up in the course of that dialogue, which was, given the fact that Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue only a few years ago passed a $73 million bond to do a pretty substantial number of capital improvements within our existing jurisdictional boundaries, the question came from District 2, well, in the event that the question of annexation is posed to the voters, will we be subject to that bonded debt, most of which has already been invested within, again, those jurisdictional boundaries? And the answer was essentially yes, that given the existing statute, we could not, our board of directors could not engage in a dialogue about how to provide some options in that regard. So this simply puts an appropriate tool in the toolbox of local government, rural fire protection districts, streamlines the process for us, makes it consistent, as Hasina has indicated, with consolidations and mergers. Thank you.
All right. Questions? Okay. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2807 and just 3105 left, right? And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3105. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3105 requires electronic submission of executive summaries of reports and notices of rulemaking that must be submitted to members of the Legislative Assembly. It prohibits members from opting out of the electronic submission and asking for a paper copy of the rulemaking notice. The measure moved on a House floor vote of 52-8. The measure has a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact. We also received from, on behalf of Senator Cruz, the Dash 1 amendment, which you have in your packet. The Dash 1 amendment adds language clarifying that if a member of the Legislative Assembly requests that a paper copy of a report or executive summary be provided, the agency or other entity responsible for submitting the report shall provide that paper copy to the member. With the measure with that amendment also has a minimal fiscal, no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
All right. And I'm glad to have with us the people who actually do the work in the Senate legislative offices instead of the people who take all the credit. Welcome to the committee.
I agree, Senator Shields. Senator Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Hoyt, and I think this is my third time appearing in front of you this session. I'm the legislative policy aide for State Senator Chris Edwards. I don't file. Never have, never will. And in 2009, when I started working for Chris, I said, we're going to go paperless. And he said, okay, make it happen. And we did, and we've done it very successfully. During the interim, I work from my home office up in Portland, and Chris works down from Eugene, and we meet halfway in Salem usually to continue doing the fine work that we do for our district. And most of the time I show up, our mailbox is packed with administrative rules, and I have to go through and recycle each one of them after we look at them. And I've been saying to him for years, it would be so nice if we could get these in electronic format. And Representative Cannon came to us with this bill at the beginning of session and said, since so many offices are trying to move towards the OneNote system and be paperless, we thought it would be a good time to try and bring this forward. We think that it will save agencies money, it will save staff time, and it will make it easier. So we signed on to the bill. We support the -2 amendments that have been proposed by Representative Cannon. I don't know if those have been made available to the committee. I will make sure that a copy gets down to you. The -2 amendments, which you don't have, but I will explain them if possible, basically say that agencies will, by default option, provide electronic copies of rulemaking notices, and if a member wants to get a specific rulemaking notice in paper copy, they can do so. It's Legislative Council's opinion that the -2 amendments will get rid of the minimal fiscal impact that the -1 amendments have been tagged with, because it won't require the agencies to try and keep track of which members are getting paper, which members are getting electronic, and then have the added cost of the printing and the postage. So we support the bill with the -2 amendments that I wish the committee had, and I will make sure it gets to Patrick before the end of the day. And that is my testimony. And I have some fine staffers with me who would like to give their perspectives as well.
All right.
Thank you, Carl. I'm Chair Shields and members of the committee. My name is Jill Gray, and I'm the staff person for Senator Jackie Dingfelder. And actually, I'm surprised that Senator Dingfelder is not listed as a co-sponsor for this bill, seeing as how it would be something that she is incredibly supportive of, and we can perhaps remedy that later. Her reasons for supporting this bill are it saves money on paper and postage, plus this is the direction that she thinks we should be going, which is using less paper. In fact, Senator Dingfelder was just saying to one of the agencies the other day, more information should be available online and we should be receiving more materials through email. And I think she actually welcomed them to the 21st century when they were finally doing that. Plus, I was just thinking about this, that we ourselves here in the legislature have been making several efforts this session to accomplish our work but use less paper. And this bill just helps us get further to that goal. On a much more personal note, we receive our mail during the interim at our district office, and our district office is very small, and we share it with two other legislators. We simply do not have the room to store more and more and more paper. And I think this is a good thing for us to do, since receiving email reports and notifications works well for us. I can only think that it will work well for other people. On a final note regarding the amendments, I know we have a -1 and that there's a -2 coming. For Senator Dingfelder, she believes that the norm or the standard that we should be using is that everyone in the legislature receives executive summary or notification of rulemaking by email. And if a legislator wants to receive a paper copy, that option should be available. But that I think we're calling it the default, should be that everyone gets an electronic copy, and then if you want a paper copy, you can notify the agency about that. That way, there's a consistent method for the agency to follow, but the focus is still on receiving information and through email. And I believe that is contained in the -2 amendments that we'll be getting later. And with that, I'm done, and Kyle, it's your turn.
Chairman Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kyle Vineyard. I'm the policy advisor for Senator Jason Atkinson, who represents a good portion of Southern Oregon. I'm here in no official capacity for the senator, but was asked by Sarah to provide a little demonstration for the committee. Being from Southern Oregon, Senator Atkinson supports timber, and so we get all of ours mailed to us, and I was asked, this is our rulemaking folder from this session alone and just the past few months. We were transitioned staff right before this session started, and I've been working for him since 2009 when I was a student at Willamette, and then again in 2010 in a special session, and then now. Only difference now, but the other two sessions is I get a paycheck now, which is a lot nicer. In 2009 and 2010, our folder for this, we had two of these, and they were chock full of proposed rulemakings. And just from a, unlike Sarah, I have filed since day one of the 2009 session, filing bills and all sorts of other things from lobbyists and different interest groups. And not that I mind, I think it's fantastic, but this is one thing that I think it'd be good to have done electronically, just because this way senators could call it up wherever they happen to be, if they're in a meeting, or if in Sarah's case, and then in Laura's case, who works for Senator Atkinson as well, and who will be staying on after the session, she'll be staying here and working from the Capitol office, and he'll be back in Southern Oregon. It's much easier to communicate and get things to each other if we're able just to call it up from an email file or something, as opposed to having to dig into a file cabinet and find it and have it take up space. So with that, we'll conclude my testimony.
Senator Boquist.
I'm just curious to know where each of you live.
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, I am actually a constituent of Senator Dingfelder's, and I live in Northeast Portland.
I live in Gresham.
When I was a student, my family lives in Southern Oregon, and I oscillated back and forth between Willamette when I was in class, and then my family's home, and then now I currently live in Salem.
My point, Mr. Chair, is that 48% of my district doesn't have internet access, and even in my district office, you know, my funds don't pay for it, but if I had to use the computer, I'd never get an electronic transmission. And I know Representative Krieger is another prime example where he lives. He has no access because you can never email him anything. You got to call him on the phone and argue with his wife to get him to turn the computer on and beat it six times to get it doing it. So there needs to be, well, I'm supportive of electronic stuff. There needs to be an option for certain members in order to simply do their job in their districts to sell on paper copies. Mm-hmm. So,
fair enough.
Questions?
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having trouble. I know we don't have the dash 2 amendment, but you described it in. I'm trying to figure out what the difference is between the dash 1 and the dash 2. Which is hard because we're not looking at the dash 2, but it seems like the dash 1 allows a member to request a paper copy if that member wants the paper copy.
Senator Shields, Senator Bonamici, I believe the difference between the dash 1 and the dash 2s is that the dash 1s would basically set up a system where the member would have to choose if they wanted electronic or if they wanted paper, and so then it would fall upon the agencies to keep track of who's receiving paper and who's receiving electronic. The dash 2 amendments, which I'm apologizing that you don't have in front of you, would say that each member shall receive them electronically, and then if a member wants a specific rulemaking notice, they can request that one in paper form. I believe the dash 1 say that all rulemaking notices will be available through paper. So I think Senator Cruz is here, who can probably better speak to his dash 1 amendment.
He's back there shaking his head. I don't read it that way.
I'm not sure. I was provided a summary of both the amendments by Representative Cannon's office, so that was my understanding in reading their email and the email chain between them and Legislative Council, but I'd be happy to run back up to my office and send down those dash 2s for you guys within the next couple minutes. So
that's all right, and we're going to close the hearing shortly.
Of course, Mr. Chair, you can't do that because my system's froze up and IT's trying to unfreeze it because it has too much electronic stuff sent to it already. And I am stuck without any electronic system until such time. So there are problems, and the dash 2 is a problem, Mr. Chair.
I think there should be a telegraph around here somewhere.
Number 10 can in the string.
That's right. Well, if you all could clear the way for Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. When I read this bill, it was one of the early bills that came out of the House. I support the bill. I absolutely do. But when I read it, it basically, there was nothing in there that would allow a legislator to get a paper copy of a report or executive summary. And for me, that's important. And I say that Senator Atkinson is new age. He's one of those guys that probably has two computer screens. I don't know how that works. But, I mean, you know, he's addicted to the Apple computer and the other, you know, I know Senator Dingfelder is pretty savvy as well. But for me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if it's a report I care about and it's a report I want to really dig into, I need to have a paper copy so I can mark it up. This amendment doesn't require an agency to do anything except if a legislator requests an executive summary or a report in a paper form, they send it to them. It's that simple. They don't have to create a registry or anything. Everybody will get it electronically, like the bill says, but if I see one that I think I need to spend more time with and need to dig into, I should have the right to get a paper copy from the agency. That's all the Dash 1 amendment does. And to say that it puts a fiscal on it, it shouldn't, because they're already doing that now. This doesn't change current policy. But the way I read the bill, it would basically say that an agency, if I requested a paper copy, they wouldn't have to give it to me, and I think that's wrong. No more complicated than that, Mr. Chair.
And so the Dash 2s are yours?
The Dash 1s are mine. The Dash 2s, I think we're dealing with different from the executive summaries, I believe, weren't they?
Hi.
I haven't seen the Dash 2s, so.
Yes, these are near here. Take a look.
Okay.
Hi. For the record, my name is Christy Split, and sorry I didn't get down here sooner. I had a conflict. I am Representative Ben Cannon's legislative assistant, and when the bill was drafted and it came back to us, and after I'd gathered a whole bunch of signatures, Representative Cannon pointed out that on page 4 of the bill, he thought the language was a little harsh. It basically says you can't ask for a paper copy. And we had a long, drawn-out email exchange with Dexter Johnson, who drafted the LC himself. And he said he drafted it that way in order to make sure that there wasn't an opt-in, opt-out sort of system, which DASH feels they would need to administer and have some sort of systemized approach. And we had conversations with Marjorie Taylor at DASH about this. And so what we did work out with Dexter was this idea for an amendment. And in fact, when Patrick mentioned the Dash 1s, we thought that was our amendment that we'd had drafted and which hadn't actually gone through the process. So we had had this long conversation but then never actually got the Dash 1. So I saw the Dash 1 and it was different than it could be expected. And Patrick told us that it was Senator Cruz's. And anyway, we now have a Dash 2, which actually takes that issue on page 4 and says that on a case-by-case basis, members could request a copy of a rulemaking notice, which seems to be exactly what Senator Cruz is interested in accomplishing.
It does.
But it does only affect the rulemaking piece of the puzzle.
Right, and if I could, Mr. Chair, the rulemaking for me would be a secondary issue because that's a process that agencies go through that nobody knows what they do. Rulemaking is problematic in this process. Personally, I'm more interested in the reports. The executive summaries and the actual body of the report. You know, like if the Oregon Health Authority is doing a study, Mr. Chair, you and I are on that committee, we might want to have the actual body of that report because we're going to need to really drill into it. And that's the options that I want to have available to legislators.
Sure.
So I'm thinking there may be, maybe it needs to be, maybe there needs to be a Dash 3 that combines the issues of both of these.
And we could also, I encourage the two of us to talk to Dexter Johnson together.
Sure.
Or you and Representative Cannon would be far more appropriate. I'm just a stand-in. But the conversations we've had with Dash and with Dexter Johnson seem to indicate that everyone seems to think, even under the current law, it would be okay and agencies would accommodate those sorts of requests. But we want it to be a little bit more clear. And the bill is only truly limiting in that page 4 reference. So that's why when we talked to Dexter Johnson, he agreed, or he said that we only needed to amend that one piece because the piece that has to do with the reports, the executive summaries of reports, people could, there's nothing that says you can't ask.
Okay. So, I'm ready to move on.
Ms. Chair, if I could, do you want us to do this? Do you want to do it with Representative Cannon? Or?
No, I would feel very comfortable with you both coming to an agreement on a Dash 3, and we'll consider that when we see it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
So, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3105, and colleagues, we're adjourned.